Hey, everybody. Welcome. It's VFX show number 24. I'm here, of course, with Mike Seymour. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And we both just came back from SeaCraft.
Which was excellent. I just got to say, starting right off, that San Diego is a great town, and that was a good convention.
It was. I have to admit, I didn't see a lot of it. I feel like I see less and less of SeaCraft every year because I got too many meetings. But there are great places to put parties.
There are some good parties this year. If you managed to get onto the Autodesk aircraft carrier, that was a good one.
It was on an aircraft carrier.
Yeah. You know, down at San Diego, of course, large.
Was it the Midway? Is that right?
Yeah, and so after the Autodesk users group, however, there was a limit on the number of people that could get onto the aircraft carrier. So if you turned up late, thinking I'd just be stylishly late, you had a stylish wait till 1,000 people get off the aircraft carrier, and then you can get on. Kind of wait.
Jeez, that's one of the few times, because usually if you show up on time to one of these parties,
you look really
dorky, because there's like you and like eight other people. So but there were good parties. You know, Softimage had some good parties. I went to that one, and Maxon and Adobe put on a great little get together as well. And I don't know, was there any other? There's a big SeaGraph party. Did you go to that one?
I got invited to the post electronic theater party. Did you go to the electronic theater?
I didn't. I haven't gone for like 4 years. I just get the disc and get what I get.
So for those of you that don't know, at SIDGRAPH each year, there's a presentation that is basically kind of the best videos, if you can call them that. They're sort of some of those films put together and packaged up. And then they get a very good theater, get really well set up with all of the, you know, proper projectors and stuff. And they show it. And of course, it's a big event, and you get a real sampling of the best across movies, research papers, videos, short films, and of course, you know, stuff that's especially done for SIDGRAPH. And this year was no exception.
Yeah, and they do breakdowns. So you see some stuff that's like a breakdown of how things got put together. Usually it's very stylish and quick.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, ILM's had their, you know, this year's reel, which was breakdowns of stuff like Transformers and, you know, stuff they'd done for Pirates, of course. But I guess more significantly is, well, for me anyway, personally, because I kind of, you know, the ILM stuff, I don't want to take anything away from it, of course, but there are other ways you would have a chance to see that. What I love is seeing the short film that I otherwise wouldn't see. And it tends to be the place that Pixar launches its short films, of course, ever since the days of Luxo Jr. And this year, again, they had a very funny film about a guy who was basically, I guess, on, how would I describe it? He was in training for alien abductions as an alien abductor, and it was hysterically funny.
I saw that, and I can't. Was that actually playing before Ratatouille?
Yep. And
okay. So I did see it. I was like, I remember seeing that video, and I couldn't remember where. Yeah, so that was really funny.
Yeah, and it was very good. And that was the last video in the piece. And we actually got to speak to Paul de Beverick, because we were down there doing FX Guide TV, and Paul was the organizer for the electronic theater. And he said someone gave him some advice: always have the audience leave on an up note. So he left the Pixar till last, and it was very good.
The I thought that you know, I was just going to say something, and then I just completely blanked out. I was thinking about Paul de Beverick, and
I'll tell you one of the other funny things they had, and there was a short film, I'm going to forget the name now, out of London. And it was the most whacked out on Scooby Snacks thing you've ever seen. The basic premise was that there was this guy who was lazy, and they discovered through advanced research chemicals that could move things. And so a drop of red would cause this, you know, test brick to translate. And a drop of the green would cause this test brick to flip. And the drop of this test blue stuff would cause it to sort of levitate, right? And so then they got this guy who was lazy, and this is all live action at this point, and strapped onto his head a cone and then started pouring liquids onto the test subject in a test room. And of course, the CG kicks in when he starts hurling himself around the room, and it just progressively gets more and more whacked out. And it's all done as if it's some kind of French research project. And I mean, it was hysterically funny.
I really should have gone. I have to admit, there was one night I could have gone, but I was just too tired. So it was, that's typically the problem that I have, is that I just have way too much stuff going on. I really hope that some of the stuff that we saw, I know when I hung out a little bit at the ILM booth, watching some of the breakdowns of Transformers. They had a couple of the supervisors there, you know, kind of breaking down Transformers. And of course, the ILM booth becomes almost unmanageable when they start doing these breakdowns, because there's like, you know, 500 people packed in and around the booth. But some of them were so well done. Some of the breakdowns.
Oh yeah.
Of the droids and how the stuff got put together and everything else. I'm really, really hoping that that ends up in the DVDs.
Well, the best of the best this year at the Electronic Theater was actually a film called The Ark. And it was one of the guys from Cafe Express. He actually went over to Poland, teamed up with some guys over there and then Motion Control. And The Ark, I can't tell you what happens in the film because I don't want to spoil it. But it's a beautiful, very poignant piece that I guess it has the beauty and charm of something that is simultaneously gritty and dirty and very sort of tactile, and yet at the same time is beautiful and breathtaking. And that's a really hard line to walk, you know what I mean? It's the shots were magnificent, and yet by the same time, you know, remember those early attention to detail things you used to do?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys could have written the book on it, right? There was like not a single smudge, not a single kind of thing left out, and yet the whole thing was just gorgeous.
That's awesome. No, I definitely want to. Now I definitely want to see that.
Yeah,
so, that's definitely my thing. So yeah, but there a lot of good stuff. I thought that there felt like there was more energy on the actual floor this year than there has been in a couple of years. Would you?
Yeah, I thought it was good. I mean, there are some booths, as you say, ILM's one of them. Pixar's is another that, you know, almost without fail, there's just a crowd.
And great. It's like having a papers. You know, without having to pay for the conference. I mean, these guys, they break down the stuff in all kinds of detail, in enough detail. I have to admit, I think maybe because I do a lot of this stuff, I'm able to see what they were doing. And then I'm able to go, oh, now I know how I could use that immediately. I don't need any more information.
Well, I guess, so the thing that I find really interesting about SIGGRAPH as a conference is that it really has sort of levels of accessibility depending on where you are in the industry, because again, for people that haven't been recently or have only sort of vaguely know about it, the is fundamentally, Alex, isn't it, like a research conference? Like there are actual technical papers.
That's where it started. Yeah, I mean that's where its roots are in computer graphics research, and so you have a lot of academia. You have a lot of people doing what seems like esoteric research, but what happens is you see the research, and then 5 years later, it's shown on every, you know, film reel, you know, from ILM, DD to anyone else, you know.
Exactly. So at the conference, there was, of course, this year, the research papers, right? And I'll come back to one of them in a second because I had a favorite with the gigabit pictures. But those research papers are normally presented by people that are, you know, really serious about algorithmic research. And for some people, that is obviously too technical and too dry. Then they have a second level, which are the courses. Now, a course might go for half a day. And a course tends to say, well, I'm not presenting a new piece of research, but I'm showing how I use this research and how we can build on this research. Or I'm just explaining the concept and area. And that might be a half day course. And then one step down from that is like as Alex said, the trade show floor, where you can basically just go along and get the, you know, sort of half hour quick run through breakdown on how something goes. So to use an example, for example, if you were to look at say Pixar and the work they were doing in subsurface scattering and in you know, voxel point clouds of the subsurface scattering, there may be a paper on that that's discussing the algorithms of the search and how that's cached. There may be a course on Ratatouille and how they used subsurface scattering to do the food, or you could go down to the show floor and have a quick paper or a quick sort of presentation, half an hour, on RenderMan's use in Ratatouille, which would be much more just the half hour thing as opposed to a half day thing on the course. And I love that accessibility is there on all levels.
Yeah, it really works. And I, you know, I used to constantly go to all the papers and watch as much as I could and everything else. And I think that it just happened that I just got so busy with meetings and going to all these other things that I just don't get to do it as often. And I find myself just kind of randomly walking by the, you know, one of the production booths and just kind of absorbing whatever there is to absorb, you know, in the process. And it is the quality of what you learn just walking around the convention floor is much higher. Though, if once you get serious, once you're writing code or actually trying to develop something, you really need to go to all the, you know, all the papers and really keep a track of what's going on, because that really gives you a sense of where we're going to be 3 or 4 years from now. You know, that's what's happening there.
Yeah, if you want to get the secrets of the film studios without signing an NDA, go to the SIGGRAPH papers. It's upstream of them actually being incorporated into the pipelines.
So now, what was your favorite paper?
Well, I just won. I mean, there was a lot of papers that were good, and I was, like you, pretty strapped for time. But I went to the Gigapixel research paper, which I'm sure you know about.
Who did that?
It's actually Microsoft Research. There was actually a bunch of papers.
Yeah.
But they had this. They have these enormous, I'm talking enormous pictures, which are stitched together pictures, and you can basically fly around them. And there's stuff up on the web, so you can actually do it yourself. But what's interesting about it is not only the fact that they sort of pull it off, but there are sort of two levels of dynamic stuff happening on the display. One is it's effectively accessing into a high dynamic range image to sort of give you a better exposure on a zoomed up area. So if you zoom up from a cityscape right down to an alleyway to a garbage can, it might, you know, give you a better view of that garbage can rather than having it in the dark. And then the second thing it's doing is it's coping for the fact that on a wide angle lens, you can get in a city, and on a zoom lens, you can get in the alleyway. But normally you have just one fixed range, which means you either have all the buildings warped in the wide shot or everything kind of like a spherical projection. And so this thing's dynamically changing the projection as you zoom. And it's so well done that you're zooming in on the city and you're not even noticing that it's changing the exposure and changing the lens as it zooms in on the still shot. And it's hysterically funny to watch when you sort of realize that. You kind of go, oh my God, I didn't even realize that it must be doing that. Otherwise, the image would be screwed.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, the stuff that they're doing at Microsoft actually is really exciting. Part of this, we had the opportunity on This Week in Media a couple of months ago to sit down with Bill Crow, who oversees the HD, you know, the HD photo process. And in the process, he was talking to us about, you know, all the other stuff that they were doing there. And this is one of them. And I just can't think of the name. It's not Gigapixel though. It's there's another name for it right now that's in the Microsoft team. But one of the things that's interesting is it's figuring out where you take 1,000 photos of a location, and you actually get it's actually figuring out where those photos live in 3D intelligently. You know, so it processes them and figures out where those all are in 3D, which I thought to be fairly fascinating.
Yeah, that's that second research project they've got going where they're basically... Okay,
this is a different one. This isn't the Gigapixel one.
No, this is a second...
I thought this was related to it.
No, this one is... The one you're talking about is phenomenally interesting. It's almost like taking the web and working out how pictures fit together and then building a point cloud of it. And by the way...
That's what I wanted was the point cloud. I was like, I don't really care about the photos. I just want the point cloud. So
that episode that you're referring to, as I think I mentioned to you before, Alex, is one of my favorite episodes. That was a brilliant discussion, that one, that you had.
We really loved having Bill on, and we're hoping to get him on again because it was, you know, he's such a smart guy and so easy to talk to about the stuff. And it was so much cool information, you know, that we had the opportunity to talk about. So I don't even know what episode. We'll try to find that episode and put it in the show notes or something like that. But really worth checking out.
But because this is the VFX show, I guess I wanted to flag the films that were heavily covered at this year's conference. And the obvious ones are things like, not obvious, but Surf's Up was well covered, as was Spider-Man. There was quite a lot of stuff, obviously, to do with Ratatouille. I already mentioned that with Pixar, and that was very well handled. And Transformers. Happy Feet also had a session. So basically all the big animated films had detailed sessions. But the film I think that was getting a lot of attention is a film that isn't out yet, which is Beowulf. And that was really interesting. That was in the Electronic Theatre. They got it in literally the day they were putting the edit together for the showing. It is now available online, as you know, you can download. But seeing that sucker projected 4K in a proper theatre with proper sound, oh my God.
Well, I really heard, you know, there was a lot of us on a couple of mailing lists. There were a lot of us talking about, you know, about the quality of Beowulf, you know, and really whether this was, you know, is it in the what we would call the uncanny valley, you know, where it's close enough that we're expecting to see realism, but not close enough to make it feel real. And so then you feel like everybody's dead. It's kind of like where Polar Express lived, in my opinion, it didn't quite get over that hump. And this is another Zemeckis film. And I didn't see it on the theater on the screen, but what I've heard is that you really had a whole different experience. Like it was really an amazing experience. And that was your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the stepping stones are Polar Express, which I didn't think worked particularly well. I you know, I was like, why can't we just have the real Tom Hanks? I'm sure he'd act better than this, you know, electronic Tom Hanks. Then there was Monster House, which was a big step. And then there's Beowulf, which is another step again. And I've got to say, at Beowulf, it's pretty incredible. There are some areas that, you know, obviously people are going to debate about. But the question is, does it get to a point where you're not taken out of the film and, you know, sort of looking at it going, oh, that's sort of wonder what's going on with the CG, and you just sort of get immersed in it. And I think, you know, Beowulf could be it. There's another one coming after that. And as I said, we were down there doing FX Guide TV, and we've recorded an interview with Doug Chang, who was obviously on Beowulf and is now heading or VP at the new studio that they've set up with Zemeckis, because they've now broken from Sony Imageworks. And the new studio is doing the new film for 2008, which is going to be one more step again from Beowulf. So clearly there's a lot of momentum in this direction.
We'll leave that one out. I don't want anyone in trouble. So,
but I know it's a 2008 release, and it's you know another.
Everyone's really excited about it. we'll find out.
We'll mention it next week. Yeah.
So it is. And I think that you know when I saw the stuff on the video on the trailer for Beowulf, and I saw it in the theater. I think it's before. I just saw The Simpsons, and I'm pretty sure it was before The Simpsons, or maybe it was before Bourne Identity. It might have been or Bourne Supremacy or whatever it is. So, before one of those, I saw Beowulf as the trailer, and you know, I was really left with, man, they're about two steps away. Like that's what I was left with. It's like two more movies this direction, and they hit it to a point where we're really, you know, we're really doing a lot of this. I mean, Beowulf is going to be fun to watch. I think it's a great story to start with. But I think that
it's hard to judge off the trailer, though, because, you know, you don't even know the trailer shots are in the film, right?
Well, and that's what typically happens. I mean, when I was working on Star Wars, I mean, we had shots in the trailer that, you know, weren't done.
Yeah.
You know, you it was where the shot was, and it was close enough, and then we kept on working on it. So, you know, so it's hard to tell whether the trailer really is going to hit the mark, but I'm really looking forward to it. Now that's due out this year, right?
Like November, I believe. Yeah, I think. And the thing about Beowulf and why I flag it is it also, for me, highlighted a theme that I saw. If you were to map the waves of kind of momentum that are moving through SIDGRAPH at the moment, on the show floor and with Beowulf, I just saw a ton of motion capture. There was like motion capture everywhere. Organics Motion had a new system that was almost working that had motionless almost, marker. Like, you know,
this like, is the key there.
Yeah. There was a great quote on Twit this week or last week with someone saying, that's me standing outside the Reserve Bank saying I almost broke in. Yes, it is working apparently, but I didn't see it 100% working in person, but I think it's like about a month
the
before release.
The markers move around.
This was markerless. So, this was a markerless motion capture.
I don't think I missed this. I was thinking about the ones that were inertial.
No, this is basically the markerless motion capture of like a biped. So you'd walk onto a stage. It has multiple cameras, and it's against a kind of neutral white background, and it literally figures it out. Yeah, from normal street clothing.
I missed it. I don't know where was that on the show floor.
Sort of behind. If you draw a line from ILM and Pixar and did a triangle, it would be the top of the triangle kind of thing. It was a fairly big booth.
I think it was enclosed or something, and then I walked by.
And right next to it, which was really hysterically funny, was a booth selling the light stages from Paul Debevric's research that we've seen.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And so it was kind of a closed stage where they were doing the example for this one. And what happened was it was a closed stage, and I was kind of moving fast. And I saw the ball.
Buy your own light stage. Yeah, it was hysterically funny. It's like,
and I just kept on going. I thought they were all part of the same thing. So.
Yeah, no, they were two separate things. But yeah, so that was of interest. So there's a big movement in motion capture. There's a lot of motion capture stuff on the show floor, and so that seems to be a current wave. What was interesting to me, if you looked at the research papers, that there seemed to be a lot of research being done right now on stuff to do with live action photography. Partly, I guess, because there's just so much freely available, you know, digital stills cameras at such high res. So I'm predicting, so probably not a particularly ambitious prediction, that, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, we're going to see a lot of that sort of stuff using just normal cameras moving down onto the show floor. And
what do you mean by using normal cameras?
Well, for example, the motion capture system of ILM is a motion capture system that uses the one camera that is the film camera, right? It's not using multiple cameras and special rigs or passive sensors and stuff. It's just using, you know, the film camera to do the motion capture. Similarly, a lot of the research papers were doing things like putting in, like take a lens of a 35 millimeter, you know, zoom lens that would be onto a digital SLR and change the aperture from the classic thing that you see on your iPhone when you take a photo that, you know, scissors open and shut, to a kind of a grid thing. And that allows the camera, when taking the photo, to work out the inverse blurring so that it can not only defocus the image, but it can deconvolute it in such a way that it works out the Z information. So to speak in English instead of complete maths for a second, you put this special lens on, you take the photo, it looks kind of out of focus, then you wind in whatever you want to be in focus. And not only that, but it can give you a Z map depth of the image that you're taking. Now, this is at research level, right? So it's not like I can point to any film or anything that's doing it, but there were two papers in the same area. So this seems to be just a trend to a lot of stuff to do with photography and stuff that's happening now. And obviously, as we've discussed in the past, anything that's at the research papers now, 2 or 3 years from now, will start showing up in films, and then 5 years from now will be in applications.
Well, I remember we saw a paper about this crazy thing that Paul Debevec was working on called HDR. You know, this idea that you can have a high dynamic range and you could take multiple exposures and I think that might be my iPhone there. But you could take multiple exposures, and it just seemed like it was insane. And so we got into it. We got all excited, and there was no tools. There was no nothing. There was no, you know, so we were making all these HDRs and putting them all together. And first we were shooting the spheres, and then we were using, you know, these Nikon 4500s with little 180-degree lenses. And we were doing all the, you know, kind of playing with it, but we felt like alone and alienated. And every time we talked about HDR, it wasn't a big deal. Now it's in Photoshop.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you would never go on a movie set without shooting HDRs.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. But that was, you know, that's really the
I gotta say, I'm a bit envious if you went to Paul's first paper on that, because that was really like, that's a moment in time. That was.
I remember talking to. Well, he was. He it was before the paper, and he was actually touring ILM or something like that, and he was trying to explain to me photogrammetry because they were working on that as well. And I was like, yeah, we do that. It's called camera mapping. You know, it wasn't, but he couldn't quite get past me, because every time I heard it, I just was like, yeah, we do this thing where we map this stuff on, and we call it camera mapping. You know, I didn't quite understand what he was talking about. And then when we got into, what's interesting is you have. I think that one company that I saw on the floor is doing a lot of this stuff, and they don't get quite the press. But did you see what RealViz is working on? Did you?
Yeah, no, I love the people at RealViz. We visited them at their offices last year, actually.
And what I find fascinating is you go over and watch the Transformers thing, and they're talking about shooting. You know, we took these photos, and then we built models, and then we have these HDRs, and. They're doing it, you know, of course, ILM's doing it with all this proprietary software that they're putting all together. And then, but that's the stuff I've been doing in vTor and in Stitcher and, you know, that type of thing for the, you know, and it was interesting to see them doing the same operation. Nothing that you could do that in some of the RealViz products. And sometimes I feel like RealViz is they have a hard time getting over that hump. You know, people seeing what they could do with the software. And I think I know on the Mac side, it can be a little bit, you have to kind of wrestle with the software.
Yeah, and I've been using it for a while, and I think it's great. I mean, it was one of the first to really nail the equalization of the images across a Stitcher pattern that, you know, you didn't get the sky looking like a patchwork quilt, but a clean blue as it was patched together. I think they did really good work.
I will say that on the Mac side, the hard part was like Match Mover. On the PC side, works really, really great, and we prefer it for green screen because you can manually track stuff.
It is good. I'm a PF track boy myself.
Well, I, what I'll say is that when once you move to real life, you know, anything that has lots of detail in it.
Yeah.
And we tend to then start leaning towards PF Track or Buju. You know, those are the ones that, and I have to say on a Mac, you know, the Match Mover isn't a really great solution. It's just not quite the same as it is on the PC.
Yeah.
But the VTour has turned it well. And with Image Modeler, we got really excited because we will calculate all of our camera positions, even if they're locked off.
We build
a model of a green screen with all the markers. And once we have that model, we can just lock every camera one after another, you know, into the system, and we know where all those cameras were and what their focal lengths were, and all that stuff is done really, really quickly. We don't use it the way they advertise it, but we use it in a way that works, and VTour is another one of those ones that we've just really gotten into. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting to see them kind of doing what they were doing, but seeing the exact same technique over at ILM. Now we saw with the motion capture. Did you look at the inertial motion capture?
Yeah, I think so.
They're walking around and they have little boxes that were underneath their suit.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So and I think that this is the first step towards this idea. And what you were talking about earlier is another one. Is this first step away from we don't want to do any more visual markers, because there's a lot of breakdowns. You know, you have swapping markers, and you have the markers going back and forth, but you also have issues when you deal with just occlusion and everything else. So finding a way to get past that is something that I think a couple companies are really starting to wrestle with, and I think that's probably something we're going to see happen a lot more in the next couple of years.
Yeah, motion capture was definitely the sort of the dominant cool thing of multiple companies. There was not at a point where you just said, you know, like at the moment with 3D software, right? There's XSI, Maya, and Max, right? And I mean, I'm sorry, but after that, there's like a huge fall off in use. Like, there are other good programs, I'm not saying there aren't, but you know, there's so established in pipelines that even if you came out with a better program, sorry?
From a C-graph view, I'd say that.
Yeah, and so what I'm saying is that, like, there isn't at the moment motion capture technology where you just say, well, everybody's got this embedded in their pipeline and everybody's just going to use it, and sorry, there's no room. It's not like the momentum has built up with just one approach that you feel like, well, that's it. It's kind of,
Everyone's still pretty equal when you look at the difference between motion analysis or, and then you look at phase space versus... You know, Vicon, everybody has their positives and negatives, but they're still
Vicons come down a lot in price. They slash their price down. You can get a good stage setup for like 50 grand now.
Well, I think they have to. But yeah. A good stage setup, I mean, so 50 grand is getting you like six cameras, right?
Is it six or is it 12? It's some number like that.
I thought it was like six or something like that. And six is not really a motion capture stage, in my opinion. You can't really do anything with six cameras. I mean, I have to admit, I mean, 12 to me is like a minimum number of cameras where you're going to actually get a reasonable capture. And most of the stages that I've shot in, you know, are 20 plus, and usually that's when you start getting into real resolution.
Well, they also had some software for improving the cleanup process, because, of course, as you know, that's another huge issue. It's not just getting the capture, it's getting clean, usable data out of the capture.
Right, and that can be exciting too. You know, so there's all kinds of bad things that can happen with your motion capture, as I've discovered over the years.
But we couldn't discuss SIDGRAPH without quickly mentioning the Forge competition, because that was both controversial and funny, depending on your point of view. Did you get over and see the Forge guys?
No, I missed it.
Now, you had your own mini Forge on the Sunday. Maybe you should tell us about that first.
So... I will say, so I was asked to MC a production challenge, and this was an XSI production challenge that was put together by Bradley Gabe at Stan Winston Studios. So it was Bradley, there was Dave Andrews from The Orphanage, Greg Punches from Janimation, and Todd Aquito from PsyOps.
All good guys. All really good guys.
Really top-notch animators, riggers, compositing, modeling. So you had really, really high-end guys, and they were, and their job was to take one image that actually Greg's father had done, and turn that into an animation. So they had to model, animate, texture, all these things in one day. And so they went about doing it. My job was simply to just sit there and, you know, kind of, I was kind of window dressing. I would just sit there and talk about things and push, you know, say, okay, well, this is what Greg's doing now, or this is what Dave's working on, and Bradley would get up and talk. The other thing that was, not only were they very talented at what they did, but they were also guys that have presented before. They've talked about stuff before. So we had an audience of about 80 to 100 people all day sitting there just, you know, asking questions while they're working. And especially Bradley. Bradley really got up there and was, you know, really explaining all the little details of rigging and I mean showing some stuff about rigging that was profound. And it was probably for me and I missed a lot of Seagraph, I'll admit, but for me it was probably one of the most useful days I had ever seen at Seagraph, where you had real production guys sitting there talking about real production issues and letting you watch, you know, this open piece. And it's hard to do that I have a hard time when people are looking at, one person's looking over my shoulder, let alone 100 people sitting there watching you animate or rig or model or whatever. And they just explained through the whole process, and it was, people were, I mean, as I said, I mean, 90 people showed up and stayed there for 8 to 10 hours with almost no breaks. I mean, there was like little breaks here and there, and it was a really, really fantastic experience. I'm already talking to everyone about, we need to do that in the fall. Let's do another one of these. And so we're trying to figure out a time when we can do it again, because it was just a really fantastic experience. Now, you're talking about this Forge, is that right?
Forge is Seagraph's version of that was basically, instead of being 8 to 10 hours, it was 32 hours. Lock a whole lot of animators in a room for 32 hours and give them some basic assets and then come back and let them out at the end of it and try and distract them and annoy them while they're working, basically, during the 32 hours. It's probably the best way to describe it. I mean, they literally had snake charmers, kung fu experts. The worst, apparently, was the house DJ, who at 5 a.m. just started putting on house music as they were trying to animate on the second day when they hadn't slept for like 30 hours. But the winners got a pretty good prize, actually. They got to get in a limo with the senior execs, and I'm going to say this, I think that I'm right in saying this, from Sony Pictures Animation, drive up to LA from San Diego while hanging out with all the studio execs in the back of the limo, then go to an exclusive dinner, and then be put up at a hotel in Los Angeles before being flown on to wherever they came from.
Did they take a shower first?
Yeah, they did. And, yeah. But it was fun going over there, and you'd go in there at like, you know, 11 o'clock at night, and there were teams of like 3 or 4 per animation, all working away.
How many teams?
Good question. I would guess, I should know the answer. It's like 16. Some number like 16, might be 12. And everyone, and that's sort of this Viking theme, right? So everyone was wearing sort of, you know, horn hats. And
I saw the horn hats.
It was very funny. Yeah, so it was a good spirited thing. And it got criticized by some people as being, well, why are we encouraging people to work ridiculous hours and no other industry in the world would tolerate these kind of working conditions? And yeah. I totally agree with that in one sense, but on the other, it was just fun to do it, so...
My whole thing is, I got a couple things to say about that. One is welcome to production. I mean, that's what it looks like. I mean, whether you think we should do it or not do it, you know, when you hear people complain about, oh, these hours are so long, you know that, well, they're not going to make it. You know, you're just kind of like, well, that's they're, you know, that's why I got there. I mean, I was special because I was able to work, I still work, I have to admit, you know, 80 to 100 hour weeks. And, you know, to me, I thought I was something special. I got the ILM, and that's what everybody was. That's how they got there. I didn't work. I mean, I know people will talk at ILM about working long hours. I will say, for the record, I worked for the year and a half that I was at ILM, I worked 45-hour weeks. I worked 3 Saturdays, you know, so it bumped it to 55-hour weeks. And I think I had one really, really nasty 2 weeks, and that was my own fault. And that was my reality of ILM. Now, I got there working 80 to 100 hour weeks, you know, and that's how most people get there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex problem, and it, you know, I mean, Pixar nearly lost a lot of people after one of the early films, so they really changed their work environment, and now you have a particularly good kind of attitude to the staff in trying to get them to, you know, basically have a life, and there's, you know, everything from swimming pools to volleyball courts to a creche for kids. So I'm all in favor of people being able to have a life and have a family. But by the same token, if you're starting out in the industry, if you're not going to put in the hours and meet deadlines, I guess it's more about meeting deadlines than just being a masochist, right? Yeah. If you've got a deadline, you've got to do what it takes to meet it, and you meet the freaking deadline. There's just no two ways about it. You know, it ships. There is no missing an air date. It just doesn't happen. As long as you've got that, then you're okay. Then obviously what you want to try and do is plan your work sensibly and not just leave it all for the last minute and, you know,
I think that you have to get much more reality based when you're figuring this stuff out, because it doesn't work. I mean, really, my opinion is that someone can think really hard 6 to 8 hours a day max. You know, I mean, like they can. After that, it's it's a law of diminishing returns. You know, of what you're really getting.
which is why when you're a professional, what you do is you can plan your day and you go, okay, I've got a bunch of dumb roto to do, so I'm going to do that when I'm dead, right?
Right.
Because I don't need to think for that. But I got to solve how this shot goes together. So I'm going to do that first thing in the morning when I'm fresh.
I get up and I push really, really hard for, for me, what I do is I work from, typically I'll work from 6 to 9 in the morning really, really hard to 9 or 10. And then I have meetings. I have to admit it's bad, but I don't have to think about anything technical. I just sit there and we talk about stuff. And I'm a little short, but that's about it. And then, I work another couple hard hours and then I go work out. You know, and I work out in the middle of the afternoon when no one else is at the gym. And then I come back and we do some more. You know, but it is breaking those. I have a couple days, that are good. That's how I kind of break it up. But that's what you learned when you were working in production, is that, you had to figure out, where am I going to put the breaks? Because there is nothing else. For when I was doing production before I got to ILM, there wasn't anything to do other than sleep. So it was just like one of those things that you just broke up your day in a way that, because you were going to finish at 11 or midnight and then you were going to get up at 5 and start all over again,
Yeah, by the same token, there is, just to put up the converse point of view, there is like the need for people to have families and have lives, right? Like,
yeah, you just do that when you get older.
Yeah.
It was what I'm saying is that it's not a bad thing. It's just to know that and this is what guys, get complain about, but the truth of the matter is that it's that you have to know that if you're getting into this industry, you got to be willing to put in your, there is going to be that time that you're going to work your butt off, and you're going to do all this stuff. I find newbies who come in and want to work, they just want to put their little time in here and there. That's roadkill for the people who are going to put in 80 hours a week.
Yeah.
Now, those people working 80 hours a week, they're going to get to some point where they don't need to work 80 hours a week.
Yeah, that's hopefully the case, yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, and I think most of the time,
a balance to be drawn in life.
Right.
Because, quite honestly, some of the work, the highly creative work, benefits from just having a, fresh kind of head on.
No, that's fine. That's my whole thing, is my big reason for moving away is not because I don't want to do the work. It's that I find that I just do better work when I take Sunday off, and I do better work when I take big breaks, and I do better work when I hang out with my wife and do stuff, and I come back and I'm fresh and I'm and I think of new ways of doing stuff that I just didn't think of when I'm up against the grind. So I do think that those breaks are important. I do think that's the direction that we want to go. My thing is that it's just that's typically not how you get there.
Well, this seems to be a huge rat hole on SIDGRAPH coverage, but I guess it was related at some point.
I think it's something that comes up. The only reason I kind of dig into this a little bit is that you see this conversation at SIDGRAPH all the time, and within artists all the time. They're always talking about this, in my opinion, I just hear people talk about this stuff, and I know we went down this rat hole, but I think it's something that it's just this a constant conversation.
So changing the subject, back to XSI and the guys at Soft, did you get to go to Sid Mead's presentation?
I didn't. I had too many parties, so I went to different parties. I went to the Soft one. I just went to the opening part, and then I didn't actually see the Sid Mead part.
I actually got to sit down with Sid Mead because, doing the thing. Yeah, we interviewed him, and he's it's actually on FX Guide TV's. We did 8 episodes of 8 shows from SIDGRAPH, and he's in the 8th show. And it was great. I mean, the guy is just really nice. He's in his 70s now, but phenomenally nice guy. And just hearing him talk about Blade Runner and working with Ridley and Aliens and Tron, I mean, it was astonishing. What a body of work.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. And
you guys covered, how many episodes did you do during SIGGRAPH?
8 eps, 2 a day.
How long?
Each ep was about 10 minutes.
Yeah. It was really good coverage. And that's on FX Guide?
Yeah, because of the bandwidth, we struck a deal with AWN, our friends over there. And so what happens is that, yes, it's on FX Guide, but when you click on it, it goes to AWN's media center because they are paying for all the streaming. And then we'll be putting up the longer versions of those interviews. So, for example, Sid Mead, in any one episode, what we did is we had what we called a minor and a major story. The minor story was like a two-minute, three-minute piece just about maybe a new release of software. And a major story was an in-depth interview with someone about, or, you know, an interview with somebody like Sid. The longer 20-minute version of that is being, you know, either given to our FX PhD guys or we'll go in a later episode. Because we did about, this is the ironic thing, we got out 8 episodes at SIDGRAPH and I was like really concerned about making sure we got all 8 out on time, 2 a day. It was a grind. What I hadn't allowed for is that we had such a good team working with us. We recorded enough material for 7 more episodes. So we have stuff with ILM, Doug Chang, all these great guys that hasn't even gone out yet that'll be rolling out in coming weeks.
That's fantastic. I'm afraid that I just decided I wasn't going to cover it.
Well, you can only do it if you crewed up, right? And we just had a cracker of a crew.
Yeah,
two film crews, two of everything. Editors sitting in suites just editing constantly. It was great.
I saw you guys talking to Michelle Besner, or I saw one of your crews talking to Michelle Besner about Mudbox. That was big news.
Yeah, we did Mudbox, I think, on the first episode. And that was terribly funny because we had an inkling it was coming, but we weren't allowed to say anything. As is always the case, you're running on these embargoes. But Mudbox versus ZBrush is an interesting slapdown fight. And for those people that aren't so familiar, these are both programs that do texturing of models at the modeling stage, not applying textures as a shader. And Mudbox, I guess for me, Alex, one of the things most interesting about it is that you can actually layer up detail. So in the same way in Photoshop, you have sort of 3 or 4 layers of, you know, on top of each other with transfer modes. So too, you can draw a face, then you can start adding wrinkles, then you can go to another layer and add sort of smaller wrinkles and another layer and add scars. And then the director comes in, you go, oh, I don't like the scars. You just turn that layer off. And so it's actually a kind of layered approach.
This is in Mudbox.
Yeah, this is in Mudbox.
Yeah. And Mudbox is much more of a traditional 3D app. So it feels more like a 3D app. ZBrush kind of fell into where it is. So, you know, ZBrush, when they came out, it was kind of this cool, like, 2.5D thing where you're kind of working with 3D. And so you could paint in detail, but they had a 3D engine in there, but you didn't really have access to it. I remember when they first were at SIGGRAPH, and I don't remember what year it was, but it was a long time ago. They were it was probably 1999, I think, that they showed up at SIGGRAPH, and I remember going and asking, can you export when you're doing that? Can you export OBJs? And I got this kind of blank look, like, why would you want to do that? You know, and so they finally, you know, added, you know, I wasn't the only one that asked for that. And so when I saw it, you know, and they finally added, you know, the export. And what happened was, is a bunch of people just suddenly realized what they could do with it. And it wasn't, I don't think it was really by design, by ZBrush's design. It wasn't like they had this grand plan that they were going to become this paintable thing. It was guys, I believe at Weta, that really were the first ones that really took this to the next level. Would you agree?
I with everything except for the people at Weta, because I'm not so sure about that last bit, because I know the Mudbox guys actually started at Weta. They were at Weta when they split off and developed Mudbox.
Well, no, but I think that ZBrush, I think what happened was, and I could be completely wrong on this, but my understanding was, is that they were working with ZBrush, and Mudbox is kind of like all the things we didn't like about ZBrush.
Yeah, you probably got a much better understanding of that than me. I know that ZBrush, just to give it its dues, actually is working at a really high resolution now, higher resolution than Mudbox. And ZBrush is, in fact, a very, very valid part of the production pipeline.
I'd say that most people that I talk to at the show, I ask them about that, between Mudbox ZBrush or ZBrush. And almost all of them said they liked ZBrush better. They said that they get, the guys said they were getting more detail, they had more polygons, they were able to do more deep, you know, more stuff with it. They said they liked the interface with Mudbox better, but it wasn't as powerful. That was the input that I got over and over and over again. I don't know what your input was.
Yeah, well, the interesting piece of news then that we're referring to is that Mudbox was bought by Autodesk, the owners of Max and Maya. So
now they see a lot more, you know, obviously more integration between Max and Maya, as well as probably, you know, that hopefully they're going to get more funding to do more interesting things with it, you know, so.
Yeah, with Motion Builder in that mix, it is an amazing arsenal of stuff that Autodesk has.
Well, and I think if anything, Motion Builder though is an example of what could be dangerous about it, which is that I personally think, and I've said this I think a couple times, is that I think Motion Builder is the most interesting thing that Autodesk has. It is a revolutionary tool. I mean, the kind of stuff that you can do with that, and we did a lot of work with it for VH1. And we used it as a back end tool, and then really realized we could render out shows for the show, show from Motion Builder, and it revolutionized our pipeline. We were doing real time work, we were editing it, and being able to just pump it right out. There are people in Canada that are doing that right now. It's an exciting piece of software that has gone nowhere since it was picked up by Autodesk, and they're working very hard on taking some of the technology out of Motion Builder and getting it into Maya, but. You know, we don't know how much we should do with it because we don't know where it's going to go, you know, what they're going to do. You get kind of these side, you know, well, it's not going away, but you're not getting any growth. And, you know, what I'm afraid of is that what we're going to see is Mudbox get bought, and then it ends up in the middle of this kind of process of, what's, you know, of incorporating it into Maya or Max. You know, and I don't know. Does that occur as a concern for you at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. Because one of the problems is that people simultaneously want it to remain separate and also be more integrated. It's almost like people don't want to break what they like. But so, I mean, for example, just take Max and Maya, for example, right? There's like half the school that says, why are these two products sitting side by side competing? And the other school that says, whatever you do, don't screw up my Max or Maya pipeline by changing it fundamentally.
Right. Yeah, so I think it'll be interesting. I mean, I'm not a user. I think part of my sensitivity is I don't use Maya or Max. But I do use Motion Builder, and so I'm in that mode of, you know, don't mess it up, you know. And so, but you know, you want, there's all these things that we were hoping to see out of Motion Builder that have just never really occurred, you know. And so, and it's so close. You know, that's the problem, is that you were hoping that you'd see more money and turn it into more refinement and everything else. But it'll be interesting, you know, if they invest in Mudbox, I think they have an incredible application by itself, you know, without whatever it adds to Maya or Max.
But in rounding out our SIDGRAPH coverage, we should point that this doesn't actually denote a complete change of direction for the VFX show, does it, Alex? We've just decided to take a sort of a side turn into discussing SIDGRAPH.
Ron and I did that last year.
Yeah. But we will get back to doing film stuff as well.
Yes. Yes, there are definitely films to be talked about. Was there any other big news? There was a lot of stuff we can't talk about.
Yeah, it's annoying to say that, isn't it? But it's just unfortunately the case that if you've got some good profile in the industry, people are keen to get some early impressions from you, but they're just not ready to discuss it yet. And I know it sounds a bit miserable to say that, but unfortunately, NDAs being what they are, and, you know, there's a whole lot of reasons. I find the states now, American companies are incredibly restrictive in what they'll say to people on future stuff publicly.
Well, especially if they're a publicly traded company. So publicly traded companies now are, you know, it's just a nightmare. The Sarbox, Sarbanes-Oxley rules of engagement are a good reason to not become a public traded company in the States. I mean, so what happens is you end up with these companies who just can't tell you anything. They can't tell you legally, you know, and it's really frustrating. Mm. So it is exciting. I mean, I think that we're seeing, I don't know if it was that this way for you, but I thought it was one of the most exciting SIGGRAPHs I've been to in a long time.
I thought it was spectacularly good, actually. I think complete cred to the SIGGRAPH organizing committee, who did an outstanding job. The millions of friggin' volunteers that were there, Cindy, working day and night, were terrific. San Diego, great city, great convention center. We were in a hotel just opposite, so we could just walk over. I mean, compared that to Vegas, and oh my God, it was just so much more pleasant.
It was definitely an improvement. I'm in this campaign to try to move SIGGRAPH to San Francisco, because I go to all these different cities and I really like having the convention center right next to all the hotels and lots of the restaurants and all the pieces, and I don't have to go anywhere. And I find Vegas to be nearly intolerable.
Yeah. And 2008 has SIGGRAPH back in Los Angeles as its alternate.
Which I like. I mean, I'm kind of comfortable there. And then I guess 2009 is in New Orleans, which I think is nuts, but that's fine. I didn't like it in the first place.
The Blues, you gotta love the Blues.
Yeah, but there's nothing worse than being in New Orleans in August. I mean, you walk out and you are instantly wet. I mean, I've never been
in New Orleans in August, but when I was in New Orleans, it was gorgeous and I loved it. That was pre disaster.
I was there in 1995 for Seagraph, or 1996, I think, for Seagraph. And the two things that I remember were, one, that I was wet every time I left my hotel room. You know, I was in the French Quarter, and I'd just walk out, and I'd be wet. I mean, it was just so humid. And the second thing was, is I was standing somewhere in New Orleans, and I was talking to a guy from New Orleans, and I said, what is that water out there? It's above us, you know? And he goes, that's the ocean, you know? And I was like, so we're below the ocean. And he's like, yeah. And I said, okay, I'm never coming back here. This whole place is going to turn into a swamp. And he laughed at me, and I was like, oh, I'm not, this is insane. And so I don't think
when I was up at San Fran and visiting you guys before I went down to LA and San Diego, I must admit thinking, you know, because last time I was in San Francisco, there was a minor earthquake. And I just, you guys have the same attitude to earthquakes as New Orleans
That's true.
Used to have no, to the,
I'll give you that. Because I mostly enjoy the earthquakes. Oh, we got a little bit of a rumble. You know, you don't ever think about it as being, we haven't had a big one for so long.
Cross fingers.
Yeah, exactly. So
I have to get back to stuff, but it's been enjoyable talking with you.
Yep, absolutely. And until next week, not next month, not next quarter, but next week, keep it real.